Blog Talk Radio.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble's face. You won't see him again. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, American.
Welcome to another exciting show with Southern Sense on Blog Talk Radio. So turn up the volume and enter our chat room, or grab your phones, call in, and join the conversation. Help us to restore the republic to this country and inspire the majority to be silent no longer.
Well, look me straight in the eye. Tell me what you see. I'll tell the truth every time. Yes, you can count on me. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up? Don't sit down. Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, 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 American.
Good Friday afternoon. If it's Friday and it's 2 o'clock on the East Coast, then it's Southern Sense. Welcome aboard to another exciting adventure here on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your hostess with the mostest, the radio chick, Annie, with my debonair, my suave, my sophisticated, my oh-so-politically savvy jailbird, Cool Mike. Good afternoon, Mikey.
Good afternoon, Annie. It is great to be here. I was not quite incarcerated. For those wondering what that comment was, I texted Annie, I said I'd be a little late. Stupid black owned brought a kazoo to the meeting today, and every time the fat cat would get up for his bullshit, he kept quacking the kazoo, and right away, without even looking, they're like, that's Cool Mike. So sure enough, who gets escorted out? Me. Anyway, so, but I'm on parole. They were all laughing. I just got walked out the building. So when I texted you, we were walking down steps. So basically, the meeting has concluded. Nothing accomplished. Similar to your situation, Annie, before we get rocking, similar to your situation there with the property tax, 11 people were there today on something that's going to affect thousands. So everyone's going to get a C from about $13 to $120. So that's it. Nobody cares. You know what? Whatever. So that's that. I'm free, and I'm excited to be hosting, not from behind bars.
Well, thank you so very much that you managed not to get yourself busted. But
you'd think more people would care. I mean, you're talking... forget it. Let's just do the show, morons.
Yeah, actually, I've stirred up a firestorm here in my little county by fighting the county against the property tax raise. And it's actually the millage raise on everything that's taxed in the county here. Plus, they're just
They're contemplating a 1% sales tax referendum on projects not even on the books yet, projects that are not even on the drawing board. Then you throw in the state wanting to raise the gasoline sales tax 2 cents a gallon and allowing the counties to decide whether or not they're going to implement it. Well, duh, what county is not going to implement it?
It's yeah, no to taxes, right?
Plus, the feds are thinking about raising the gasoline sales tax. Yeah, it's just they're hitting us as if we're just a cash cow. It's got to stop somewhere. And don't get me going, because I will do an entire show on the BS that government does to us. Oh, please.
At all levels, too. Before we do our dedication, just a quick note. Here in Grand Rapids, they want to start charging you to park on the residential streets. So you have to have a permit now, even though you are a homeowner and the streets are public. In order to park there, they want you to buy a 6-month permit, so it's not even a year. Secondly, if you were to come and visit me, Annie, I would have to buy a guest pass for you.
A guest pass to enter the city?
No, to park on the street. So basically, the people who issue tickets can just walk around. Normally, it's parking meters, and then they issue tickets when their meter expires. This is if any car does not have one of these stickers or a guest sticker, they get a ticket. Now, on top of that, Annie, you can appeal this, and it goes to an appeals board, a bunch of citizens, most of them who don't even live in the city.
Hey, listen,
how do we ever get mixed up in this?
For one contact question to park in my front yard. How's that sound?
That sounds good. Anyway, whatever. That's the situation, and we'll move on with the show, but I didn't end up going to jail. Just walked out the building. They had like 50 people walking me out, like I was armed and dangerous or something.
Was it filmed?
He said the cops said they're all fighting over who gets to walk me out because they were bored. They're just like, oh no, we don't want to stick around for the meeting. So anyway, then he took me to the cafe so I could get a pop, and then I walked home. So anyway.
Right.
I get out of the cop car in the cafe, and everyone's looking at me, and they start clapping. They're like, well, you did it again, Mike. And I says, hang on, I got to get hurry up for the show. But anyway, that's that. Here we are, Southern Sense. A couple of rebels here, aren't we?
It's amazing. Anyway, for those that listen, know that we dedicate each show to a fallen hero. And sometimes they have not fallen in the field of battle. Sometimes they fall into obscurity and are never remembered again. And today's show is dedicated to one of those brave men. It is Army Sergeant Henry Lincoln Johnson, who on May 14, 1918, while incurring 21 separate wounds, rescued a fellow soldier from German captivity, killed numerous Germans with a knife and a rifle. So this goes out to Sergeant Henry Lincoln Johnson, U.S. Army. So let me see if I can pull up the Army taps, and here we go. This is from TheExaminer.com, dated May 26th of this year. While most Americans never heard of this man, he is quite possibly the most compelling soldier story you will ever hear, and one which deserves to be told over and over again. In the wee hours of May 14th, 1918, a German raiding party of at least 24 soldiers operating in the Argonne Forest set out to capture American soldiers. The Germans came upon a post occupied by Private Henry Johnson and Private Needham Roberts and surprised the newly armed Americans. Johnson was immediately wounded and Roberts was captured. Johnson then went after the German raiders, firing his French Lebel rifle until it jammed, then using it as a club, bludgeoning enemy soldiers until it broke in half. Johnson managed to grab a grenade from one of the Germans, which he threw into a group of raiders, killing several of them. He then pulled his bolo knife and dragged the disabled Roberts back to their post, still fighting off Germans along the way. When French troops arrived a few hours later, they found Johnson and Roberts inside their post laughing and singing songs. They also found several dead and dying German soldiers strewn about the ground. Johnson sustained no less than 21 separate wounds during the fight. Since Sergeant Johnson's unit was comprised solely of black troops, at the time they were not allowed to fight with U.S. forces. Thus, the 369th Infantry Regiment, known as the Harlem Hellfighters, was attached to the 16th Division of the French 4th Army. Johnson from New York was forced to fight under the French flag, although he volunteered for the U.S. Army. Because of Sergeant Johnson's superhuman deeds and selfless determination to save his comrade, Needham Roberts, France awarded him that nation's highest military honor, the French Croix de Guerre with Gold Pond. And for those who do not know what Croix de Guerre means, it literally means the Cross of War. The citation for that award reads as follows. Johnson, Henry, 13348, private in Company C, being on double sentry duty during the night and having been assaulted by a group composed of at least one dozen Germans, shot and disabled one of them and grievously wounded two others with his bolo. In spite of three wounds with pistol bullets and grenades at the beginning of the fight, this man ran to the assistance of his wounded comrade, who was about to be carried away prisoner by the enemy, and continued to fight up to the retreat of the Germans. He has given a beautiful example of courage and activity. Upon Johnson's return to the United States, he received a ticker tape parade along New York City's Fifth Avenue. After hearing his story, former President Theodore Roosevelt proclaimed Johnson to be one of the five bravest men who fought in World War I. While France saw it fit to bestow their highest honor upon Johnson, his own country has yet to do the same. Some 80 years later, as directed by New York's Governor Pataki, the New York State Division of Military and Naval Affairs submitted an official Congressional Medal of Honor nomination in Johnson's behalf. On 2001, Secretary of the Army Louis Caldera approved Johnson's nomination for the Medal of Honor. However, Joint Chiefs Chairman General Henry Shelton recommended he not receive the award due to, quote, failure to follow procedure, unquote. However, in February 2003, Johnson was posthumously awarded the Distinguished Service Cross, the Army's second highest honor. The award was presented to his son, Herman A. Johnson, who served in World War II as one of the famed Tuskegee Airmen. Herman, his son, died the following year. Though the U.S. government has never recognized Johnson's bravery with the Medal of Honor, they did see fit to use him to help recruit young black men into the Army. They not only paraded him about in 1918, but used his images decades later, and in a 1976 recruiting poster which declared, Johnson left a trail of destruction half a mile long. Sadly, unable to continue his job as a porter on the railroad because of his wounds, he became destitute and an alcoholic. On July 5th, 1929, a mere 11 years later, he died alone in a veterans hospital in Illinois, separated from his wife and family. Johnson was only 32 years old. It was not until 2001 that Johnson's son would discover that his father had been buried at Arlington National Cemetery. It was a shame that in 1917, when Henry Lincoln Johnson walked into a Marcy Avenue armory in Brooklyn and signed up to fight for his country, that he was never allowed to fight under his own flag. It was also a shame that, like many soldiers, Johnson had great difficulty returning to his life at home because of physical and undoubtedly emotional wounds. It is even further shame that after more than 90 years, this man who gave himself to his country has not received the honor he truly deserves. The story of Sergeant Henry Lincoln Johnson is one worthy of a Hollywood war movie starring an Oscar cast. It is also truly an American tragedy. Unfortunately, one that continues to this day. Remember Sergeant Henry Lincoln Johnson and weep. This show is dedicated to him and to all men and women who have served who are serving and who will serve. We dedicate them this show and the song, My Name is America, by Todd Allen Herndon. God bless them and thank them.
Born in the grip of oppression, I fought for my liberty. I paid with the blood of my people. Freedom has never been free. Now my door's always open to dreamers and friends. When I'm attacked, I protect and defend. Because my name is America, I stand proud and free. My name is America, don't tread on me. I cannot be broken, I cannot be shamed. If you hurt me, I'll get stronger, and I'll rise up from the flames. Others gave it to me. They believe in the virtues I stand for, my respect for humanity. Now I'm challenged by tyrants who envy my power, but their vicious deeds become my finest hour. Because my name,
America by Todd Allen Herndon. You know, Mike, there's a lot of military people that just seem to slip to the wayside. You know, they're left forgotten. They live obscure lives, and a lot of them just pass without anyone ever knowing about their deeds and their service. And it's a crying shame. I bring this up because our guest is coming on. He's Jim McLaughlin. He's chairman of the board of the Honor Flight. Good afternoon, Jim.
Good afternoon.
Yeah. Now, unfortunately, your partner, Jeff, is supposed to be joining us. Hopefully, he'll be able to join us a little bit later. But when I told him about doing the show, I asked him for the name of a service member that he would like us to dedicate the show to. And by the time I already had the web page up and everything, he came back a little bit later with the name of a gentleman by the name of Warren Pynick. I don't know if you know this gentleman.
No, I do not.
All right, because Jeff had asked if I could make a mention of him, and I tried to find information on the gentleman. He served in World War II, and there was only just like a three-paragraph obituary, because Jeff had wanted to bring him on to today's show, and he was trying to call him, and finally he was able to reach out to someone that told him that he had passed. I think he did a web search and came up with his obituary. And I looked at his obituary, and there wasn't even a mention of his military service. So I started to dive a little bit deeper, and it was just a little tiny, little few paragraph thing. And this is only dated October 29th, just a little over a month ago, that he had passed away from a car accident. Nothing says about, you know, his life or his family or his service or anything. Nothing. They just mentioned the car accident. And then I did a little bit deeper digging, and there's a book called Divided We Stand by Joseph W. Harding. It's a book about the Forgotten War and the 181st Signal Repair Company that served in Burma, China, India, and North Africa during World War II. And these men are dying, about 1,000 a day. How many of them die like this gentleman, unknown?
Oh, my God. I know. That's sad.
That is. It's extremely sad. But what you do helps to bring to light the service of these men, and I should say also women that served in World War II. Tell us a little bit about Honor Flight.
Well, we started in 2005 with the mission of getting our veterans to Washington, D.C. to see the memorials that were built and dedicated to their service. Our primary focus right now is still World War II veterans, since they are our most senior heroes. But we have had several hubs that have now started taking Korean veterans as well as Vietnam veterans. And hopefully all of our hubs eventually will roll into Korea and then Vietnam, and on forever as long as the funding is available.
Well, this started off because it was more than 60 years before a World War II memorial was built. And
yes, it was dedicated in 2004.
Right. And there was a physician's assistant by the name of Earl Morse, and he actually came up with the idea first, because as reading his bio, he was treating these patients, and when he read about the war memorial, he started asking, would you like to go visit it? And to the man, they all said yes. And then they would come back for the follow-up visit, and they haven't gone. And they would come back for another follow-up visit, and they hadn't gone, either because they were too ill or they didn't have the money. So he actually conceived this idea, because he was also a pilot, and he would personally fly them to D.C. to see the memorial.
That's correct.
Yeah, and at the same time, Jeff Miller, who owned a business, thought of the same thing, but he thought on a bigger scale. He actually contacted, bless their heart, U.S. Air, and then he partnered with them to get them on these planes and fly more than just one or two. He would fly 100 at a time or more, which is how I find this. These two separate men who didn't know each other ended up uniting and creating Honor Flight.
Yes, they created the Honor Flight Network. Earl Morris started what he called Honor Flight. Jeff started a group called Honor Air, and ultimately when they got together, they agreed to join forces and create the Honor Flight Network.
Yeah, it's an amazing story, and, you know, it's very, very touching, because I watched the trailer and I watched the videos that are on your website. Let me make sure I get the website address correct, which is honorflight.org.
That's correct.
All right. Now, if people want to find out about it, they can go there, and then can they type in, like, their individual states, or is there something else they have to do?
At the top of the page, there's a tab called Regional Hubs. We call our groups at hubs or chapters. We have actually 135 chapters or 135 hubs covering 42 states. But if they click on that regional hubs link, it will take them to a map of the U.S. If they then click on their state, it will list all of the hubs in their state. with their web addresses, if they have a website, their phone numbers, their email addresses, so they can contact the hub that's closest to them and work directly with them to submit applications for the veterans and for the guardians and for volunteers. And they can also donate on each of the web pages to the local hubs.
All right, fantastic. I think I may have your partner in crime here.
I'm here. I'm sorry.
Okay. All right, Jeff. I hope everything is well with your wife.
Yeah, she just she has the flu. She had the flu shot over a month ago, and she just left the doctor with the full-blown diagnosis of the flu, and so I had to go pick up the antiviral, I think it's called Tamiflu, because we had to get her on it immediately. So in the time since I called you, Jim, I went by the drugstore and delivered it and got here. So that's pretty good.
That's pretty good, yes.
I hope you didn't get any speeding tickets.
I didn't pass anybody, thank goodness. So I do apologize for being late, but that was one I had to do. I have to go home to her. I don't want to be on the bad side.
I think it's going to be separate bedrooms until she gets over this.
You better believe it. My son's on the way home from college right now, and I've already told him he's quarantined it upstairs. So, we caught it really early. She had just gotten to really not feeling well. So anybody out there, if you start getting a really bad sore throat and just feel really lethargic, even if you've had a flu shot, it's worth getting checked pretty quickly. So there's my commercial for the day.
Well, hopefully everything will be all right, and our prayers are going out to her.
Thank you. It'll be fine.
When we were emailing and talking, you had given me the name of a veteran, someone that you wanted to have come on and do the honor flight, Warren Pynick. And I was
I didn't want him to come on. You said you memorialized somebody, and he was one that I talked to Jim about. Jim does a great program called the Lone Eagle Program, in addition to the TLC, their Last Chance Program. It's for veterans from all over the country that have been on a wait list and no hub is opened up around them. And he flies them in with a guardian from all over the country into Baltimore, puts them up for a couple of nights there, and turns them into one of our big groups. Takes a bus, puts them all on it, gives them, you know, their day at the memorials. And this gentleman had not been able to go. There was a hub in his area, but it had stopped. But he never could go because his wife was really ill, and he wouldn't leave her, which we've seen happen quite often.
Oh, yeah.
And she passed away, and he called and wanted to go, and Jim had said, sure, we'll get him going under those circumstances. And we had him doing the applications and everything, and then we talked every week, and then I couldn't get him. And the long and the short of it is I kept trying until finally the number was disconnected, so I entered his name in a search, and what I got was an obituary. And he had stopped to pick up some fruit at a fruit stand, and when he pulled out right in front of a big pickup truck, and it killed him. And I told Jim about it, and I won't tell you what his response was. It's pretty much what mine was when I saw the obituary. But that was just somebody who just really wanted to just say something in honor of them that they didn't get to go, but they're not forgotten.
Yeah, that was amazing, because when you mentioned the name to me, I did the same thing, and I came up with the obituary, which didn't even mention his family, didn't mention his service. It didn't mention anything about him. They just mentioned the accident. And then when I delved deeper, that's when I sent you the message about finding the book that was by Harding about his service. And here it was mentioned throughout the book. Here was someone that was worthy enough to be noted in a book, but the obituary was completely austere. And there's a lot of veterans out there. As I mentioned before, there's over 1,000 of these World War II veterans dying a day. And they're gone, forgotten, and their service never spoken of. Their dedication to our nation, what they sacrificed for us, is never thanked. And that's the wonderful thing about Honor Flight, because you give them that opportunity.
And that's what it's based around. When Earl first started talking to these guys, I missed the front end, obviously, so I don't know if Jim, you told him about Earl. You understand that he saw him every day and he heard these stories and he actually did something about it. And that's how we met. So, yeah, that's the whole mission, and it's a strong mission, and there's a lot of different arms of it that go out there that hopefully we'll have time to talk about.
Yeah. Now, you started your end of it back in, I believe it was 2005, where Earl started.
2006. He was five. I was six.
Mm-hmm. Here, the two of you, in approximately the same time period, come up with basically the same idea, but you approached it differently, where Earl personally flew them. You went and reached out to US Air. You know, tell us about that.
Sure. Earl is a pilot, and I wasn't, and I knew I wasn't going to be able to do it. And plus, I really thought that it was we needed to come up with a bigger plan. My idea was to honor my parents. My dad was a World War II veteran. He was in the Navy. My mother lost one of her brothers in World War II. He's a B-24 pilot. And they were charter members of the World War II Memorial, as was I. And we never talked about it. I never knew it until they had passed away, and I found all the things that the World War II Memorial organization had mailed them, thanking them for the donations they'd given. And it was real frustrating to me that they hadn't gotten to see it. And I talked to my wife, Tamara, and told her I wanted to do something to honor them. And I thought, let's just try and take every World War II veteran in our county, which is Henderson County, North Carolina, up to see the World War II Memorial. And to do it, we were going to have to charter an entire jet. I had no idea how many there were in my county, a lot more than I had imagined. Originally, pulled together a group of people, and we thought we'd do one flight, maybe two, and the idea just literally caught on. And the next thing I knew, we had about 300 people on a wait list, so we chartered a jet for a weekend with US Air. The story with that's pretty funny, too, because I called the guy. I was given a name by one of our state senators, Senator Tom Apodaca. He told me to call a gentleman named Chuck Allen with US Air and talk to him about chartering a jet. So I called Chuck and introduced myself, and he was kind of like, how can I help you? And I told him that we wanted to fly World War II veterans up to Washington and we needed to charter a jet. And he goes, oh, so you're in the charter business or in the travel business. I'm in the dry cleaning business. And I told him, I'm in the dry cleaning business, and there was dead silence. And I said, listen, how old are you? And at the time, he was, I think, 52, and same age as I was. I said, listen, your dad's a World War II veteran. Do you think he deserves to see his memorial? And he kind of chuckled, and he says, yeah, I do. And let me call you back. And the next thing I knew, he'd call me back, and the whole thing began. And that was in April of 2006. We flew our first two flights September 23rd and 24th of 2006. And just this past September, we flew our 300th U.S. Air charter through the Honor Flight Network. So I knew at the time if we didn't want a free jet, we just wanted a fair price on a jet. And that's something we never asked for was free. And I think that helped us a lot, because if we'd had free, then people would have had an excuse not to do it, because they couldn't have given away 300 free jets.
Right.
So the combination of what Jim and Earl were doing, they had stepped up to blocking out a large quantity of seats with Southwest, who's been an amazing partner. And flying them like that, we were flying charters out of areas that Southwest did not fly. And so they married up real well. The first flight I did, I invited Earl to meet us, and he flew up and met us at the memorial when we came in that first time. And that was the first time we'd gone face-to-face. And we met with Jim and Earl and their crew in Washington. What was that, February of 7, Jim?
Yes.
That first summit?
Yep.
And that's when we formed the Honor Flight Network. And B-24
began to work as a team.
Oh, bless your heart for that. How many veterans have you flown to the memorials?
Jim? We're still finalizing the figures from this year. But since we started, it's going to be between 115,000 and 120,000 veterans we've taken so far.
Whoa, 115,000 to 120,000?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. And that is a low ball because they will only use numbers that with groups that are officially a part of the Honor Flight Network. And there have been a lot of groups that have benefited from we've shared our, you know, our plan, our what we do with lots of groups, and some for whatever reason chose, you know, not to be a part of the network.
Right.
For instance, Louisiana had a great group flying out of there. It was Honor Air, Louisiana Honor Air. And they flew 21 flights, charters there, so there's another, at least 2,000 would
yeah.
be tacked right on top of that that we don't count.
That's an amazing figure. Now, there's a lot of groups that actually merged with you, because I know here in Savannah we had Hero Flight, but now they call themselves Honor Flight. And I spoke to them, trying to remember, I think they were at the Tea Party Convention or something, handing out brochures, and I was talking to them about it, and it was the first time I heard of something like this. But we also have, I think it's a total of 4 groups here in South Carolina alone that cover everywhere from upstate all the way down here to the low country. So states have some of these 42 states that have these groups have more than one in there.
Oh, yes.
Right?
Yes. We have several, such as California and Florida and Texas have, you know, 8 or 10 hubs in Texas, 8 or 10 in Florida.
Yeah, and South Carolina at one time had the Greenville-Spartanburg area, Charleston, Myrtle Beach, Columbia, all flying at the same time. Mm-hmm. North Carolina had Charlotte, Asheville, Raleigh, Greensboro, Wilmington, and Greenville had all flown at one time or another. So, yes, there's quite a few that some come and go and, you know, others step in. And it's a moving target as far as a number goes, but it's been impressive.
Yeah, what I find amazing is my father was a World War II veteran, and he very rarely talked about his service. The only thing he would tell us when we were growing up is how they wanted him to go into the reserves and to stymie them and to just to frustrate them and keep, you know, driving them crazy. He would fill out the paperwork to go into the reserves, but he'd mail in the first and last sheet. And then they would send it back to him with another application telling him to fill it out all over again. And he'd send in the middle sheets. And he would, you know, each time, you know, fill it out, but, you know, leave out certain sheets. Now, had these people been smart enough, if they put all the sheets together from all the applications, they would have had a full application. But he just decided to frustrate him. And for the longest time, that's all I knew about his military service. Until last year, I was down visiting them, and my father came out with a scrapbook that he had just recently put together. And he sat down with me, and the two of us for hours went over the scrapbook of all of his, you know, pictures and everything he had taken while he was over there, telling me the stories. And it was the first time I heard about it. But this is the same story about a lot of these veterans. They don't talk about what they went through. They came home. They slipped into the woodwork. They raised their family. They helped build our nation into what it is today.
Rebuilt the world.
That's right.
Absolutely. And they don't talk about it.
Yeah,
we
hear that a lot.
Humble heroes.
We hear that a lot from the families after the trip, that suddenly Dad has now drug out that album, that photo
yeah.
album, that trunk he had in the attic or whatever.
Yes.
And they hear something they've never heard before.
They actually realize they really did do something.
And they literally changed the world, physically changed the world. And, you know, these men and women, I should keep on having to reiterating that there were women, too, that were out there. They may not have been physically on the front line, but they were in harm's way every inch of the way. And they just quietly slipped back here into the fabric of our nation, and just no one knew. No one knew until after everything was said and done. And like your friend, Warren Pynick, no mention in his obituary about his service. You know,
I think what happened there was it happened so suddenly that they just were totally unprepared for it. And I did track down the daughter in Myrtle Beach, and we are talking with her right now. She wants to bring her father-in-law, who is a World War II veteran in that area, and her father's, you know, honor at the same time. He too is a World War II veteran. So when I talked to her, she was so distraught that I think they just did an obituary and didn't really think, because I asked her if they had a flag or anything, and she said no.
No, it is absolutely amazing. These men and the sacrifices, and women, I can't forget them too. Now, you do this where the veterans don't pay a penny?
Correct.
That's correct.
All right. But you go a step beyond that. You make sure that when they get on that plane, they have a volunteer there to help them, whether it's pushing their wheelchair or making sure they take the medications or just simply a shoulder to lean on, plus medical staff.
Yes, that's correct. Well, we call them guardians. Now, the difference is the guardians do pay their own way, but the veterans do not pay anything. We feel they've paid enough. It's time for us to pay back.
And there's a line waiting to be a guardian, so that's never an issue. And we have found, too, when someone just couldn't afford to have a guardian, we always make sure they have one. You know, we won't let that keep somebody from getting to see the memorial.
Now, you know, you said you have a waiting list. How do you determine who gets to go and who stays?
With the veterans or the guardians?
Let's start off with the veterans first, then we'll, you know, talk about the guardians.
Veterans we do on a first-come, first-served basis, based on the date of their application. We don't, you know, try to pick and choose, you know, one because he is older or he's in a certain branch of the service or anything like that.
There is a terminal illness, which they do take that into account, you know, something that's really pushing it, and then they get bumped up.
We have a special program we call TLC, which stands for Their Last Chance, and that's any veteran who has been diagnosed with a terminal illness and less than 1 year life expectancy.
And that's from any era, too, to point out, Vietnam, Korea, the more contemporary conflicts even. So that's a program that Jim oversees, and, boy, you ever want to be a part of an emotional trip, that's the one.
Wow. Yeah,
and in that case, they do go to the top of the list. Otherwise, it's the dates. With the guardians, it's a little more complicated. We like to have some people on the flight that do have some medical expertise. We're interested in young, vigorous people who can serve physically or strong enough to serve as guardians, to be able to assist the veterans on and off of the bus, in and out of their wheelchairs, you know, whatever physical assistance the veterans need. And oftentimes, we have an awful lot of our guardians that are Vietnam vets. The timing is right for them to be serve as a guardian. They feel very strongly that they want to honor the World War II vet by serving as their guardian. And they're young and vigorous enough to do it.
Now, you guys did a movie, the Honor Flight movie.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
That was actually done by one of our hubs, Stars and Stripes hubs out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And they followed the life of four veterans that had gone on their trips. It was actually a compilation of several different trips that the movie was put together from. But they put together a 90-minute documentary called Honor Flight, the Movie, which is absolutely fantastic. And when they first introduced the movie, they did a trailer at Brewer Stadium in Milwaukee and set a new Guinness Book of Records for the most people ever to attend an initial viewing preview like that of, I think, almost 29,000 people in Brewer Stadium. They have since received at least five different awards for the movie, and has now been shown to hundreds of thousands of people. several of our hubs have purchased the movie, and they are showing it and using it as a fundraising tool.
Wow. Now, I actually downloaded it. I haven't had a chance to watch it because I downloaded it late last night, and I have it sitting on my computer waiting to view. But, you know, for it only costs $3.99 to rent it, and I believe it's, what, $9.99 to buy it?
I think so, yes.
And they can get it through iTunes and Amazon. I went through Amazon to get mine because I have an account with them there. But I was reading about this, and one of the gentlemen in the movie, he was actually on the cover of Life magazine as the human skeleton because he was in a German prisoner of war camp, and he was only one of three that survived out of his entire group that was captured. And I found that phenomenal. And here he is, just a humble, soft-spoken man.
Yes, I had the privilege of meeting him.
He's a great guy, and you would never know that he was that fellow because he is a healthy, strong gentleman now.
Yeah.
Yeah, when he was liberated, he weighed only 70 pounds. Oh, my goodness, I can't remember the last time I weighed that little.
And the gentleman in the picture with him that was kind of behind him died right after the picture.
Yeah.
Or a very short time after that, and... He's a very neat man. All of the folk that are in that movie are special. They're very representative of that generation.
Well, his sidekick was Harvey Kurtz, and he was one of the ones that actually watched the flag go up after the Battle of Iwo Jima.
At Iwo Jima, yes.
Yeah, and he bagged groceries.
He's a hoot, too.
You think about these stories and, you know, what these people have gone through, it's absolutely phenomenal. I can't say enough about them. You think about it. Back in 2011, it was an average of 640 World War II veterans were dying each day. But now, just a mere two years later, it's over 1,000 a day. And that's a huge jump, but no one talks about this.
Well, at one time it had gotten up to almost 1,500 a day,
right?
And now the pool is so much smaller to draw from that it's actually reduced. Isn't that right, Jim?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, that it's gone down simply because there aren't as many. There were 16 million at one time, and I hear numbers now between a million and 1.4 million, but I really don't know what the accurate number is.
I think that's the range the VA is still estimating as well.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was going off of. So it's, you know, the window is more and more narrow. We used to take a guardian, and he or she would be responsible for two to four veterans back in the beginning and would have no trouble doing it. Now everything is pretty much one-on-one with very few exceptions.
It's a phenomenal thing. Now, as the World War II veterans dwindle down, you did say you're going for the Korean and Vietnam War veterans?
Yes,
in some areas, yeah. Jim,
can
elaborate on that.
We have several hubs that have taken actually more Korean veterans than they have World War II veterans, simply because they can't find a World War II veterans nearly as easily as they had been. We're compiling those figures now, and hopefully in a few weeks we will have the actual numbers as to how many World War II veterans were taken, how many Korean, and how many Vietnam. And a few that are even earlier than that, if they were terminal. I've taken some younger servicemen who were terminal that did not serve even in Vietnam. But we will have those final figures. And I was surprised. I've been looking at the year-end reports that we're getting now from our hubs, and I'm surprised with how many are taking Korean veterans and how many are taking a lot of Korean veterans. I'm very pleased to see it.
No, I am too, because, matter of fact, as I mentioned, my father had served World War II. When he met my mother, my grandmother would not let him marry until her brother, my uncle, came back from Korea. She said, until, you know, Felix comes home, you're not getting married. And sure enough, 1953, they finally were able to marry because the war had ended. But my grandmother, stubborn old little Italian woman, just put her foot down. Now, I've got my co-host here with us. So, Mike, why don't you jump in? Cool, Mike.
Hey, I'm listening. I'm doing listening. So keep going. This is outstanding.
How you doing, Mike? This is Jeff.
I'm doing great. Thank you both for what you guys do. That is amazing. One quick question. You had mentioned about taking a lot more Korean veterans. Does that just show the rarity of how hard it is now to find a World War II vet still alive?
Yes, yes. And this, it means that we have come close to totally saturating those certain areas in terms of Korean or World War II veterans, and we're able to move on to Korea. That's
and
good
some
news.
Groups, like here in North Carolina, they immediately jumped out, and we took every North Carolina veteran, World War II veteran, we could get, you know, get in contact with. I'm sure there were some exceptions, but everyone we knew about, we had flown. And most of those groups disbanded because they had their mission on the front end there was to get the World War II veterans there because it was the last memorial built. And it was the war farthest back. It was 59 and a half years before it was opened. And so there are some places that, including North Carolina, that have not gone to Korean veterans yet. It'd be wonderful if we could, but that has not been the case. But every World War II veteran that had signed up had been taken. And we here in my area, we immediately, when we ran out of World War II veterans, the economy had really turned down, and we started working with homeless veterans in the area, getting them back on their feet, retrained, working with a facility where they could stay for 2 years in conjunction with VA hospital there, working on everything from actual injuries that went back to wars and, addictions, substance abuse. And we created a fund called the Operation Welcome Home Fund that retrains them in jobs that are life skills. I mean, really culinary school, commercial driving, truck driving, things like that. So it jumped into there as opposed to going right to the Korean veterans. But in my perfect world, that's sure what we would all do because once you see how excited any veteran is about the recognition that they're given, you realize there's a lot of merit to it.
Now, we got a question up in the chat room. This person, this gentleman, I'm assuming, just asked the question, do you know anything about going back to Nam to face their ghosts?
We have not
like
had
that.
Any hope to attempt to do that yet, no.
You know
yeah,
of any group
that's...
That's
a huge step there.
Wow.
I've known individuals that did it on their own.
Yeah.
But when you look at the cost of doing that, it's do we do that or do we fly them in and let people thank them for what they've done and hope that we can change a life for quite a few at once. But I'm sure that's, you know, there's a lot of Vietnam veterans that were so mistreated when they came home that anything we can do for them, you know, I think we really should make it happen. And it's something, too, I want to point out. We had a board meeting last night, and I'll let Jim elaborate on it, but we've got our final numbers on. Jim, I think it's appropriate to talk about that, do you not?
Yes.
And where we did a hub assistance program where money that had been donated to the Honor Flight Network, which we've been very fortunate to keep continue receiving a good bit of money from folks, we spread it out all over the country, and I'll let Jim elaborate on it in the form of green passes, tickets that Southwest Airline gave us, and cash where we went in and helped hubs that were aspiring to be a hub but had shown that they're really going to do it, and hubs that were already flying, and we wanted to make sure continued to be able to maximize the number of veterans visiting. And I'll let Jim share those numbers with you, but it's astounding. And when you look at the ratio of what we receive and what we actually spend on the mission, it's pretty much one of a kind. So, Jim, go ahead and share those with them.
Yes, we had, as Jeff mentioned, we had what we called a hub assistance plan, where I sent out an email to all the hub leaders, told them we were fortunate enough to have some excess funds on a national level that we'd like to distribute to the hubs and ask them, to anybody who was interested, to submit an application, let us know, you know, why they felt they needed some help, and so on. Ultimately, we ended up, I don't remember how many hubs. It was more than 20 different hubs we were involved with. But we invested, or were actually able to distribute, about $468,000 to the veteran, to the hubs. And that took a whole lot more veterans that got to see the memorial. The other program we have, Southwest Airlines has partnered with us now for the last 4 years and provides us with free round-trip tickets that we can distribute to our veterans. And Southwest Airlines values those tickets at $400 apiece. As it turns out, last year we were able to distribute almost 1,400 tickets at $400 apiece. That comes to about $568,000. So if we total those two programs, a little over $1 million worth of assistance we were able to distribute to our hubs. And I can't tell you exactly how many hubs or how many veterans that relates to, but it's probably in the neighborhood of 3,000 to 4,000 veterans got to see their memorial by virtue of those two programs.
Wow, that's amazing. What's the average price of each one of these planes?
For the charters?
Yes.
Well, that's a loaded question. Some that are an hour out are like $38,000 for a charter. But if you go to the West Coast, we funded the longest wait list, reasonably it would seem that way, and it is the West Coast. And we've got a great group that operates out of San Diego, and we gave them a basically enough money to do one, and that whole charter, it was around $150,000, and the jet, I think, was probably close to 110 or 120, I wasn't sure. And you got to remember, that's it flies all the way across country and flies back 2 days later. And that's a long haul. So there's a huge difference in the per-seat price West Coast as opposed to East Coast. So there's really not an average, but it's U.S. Air has been extremely helpful with us in keeping their prices is almost where they were in 2006. And that's a very effective way of doing things when you don't have Southwest coming out of there, or even sometimes it's really good when you can get an entire jet and you don't have to work with a schedule that's already predetermined. It's your schedule.
Right.
That's amazing. Now, walk me through about, what a veteran would face when they come, they show up at the airport, to go on one of these flights. Walk me through what would happen to this individual.
Well, it will vary with each hub, simply because, as Jeff mentioned, if you have a charter, you can name your own time, so you can determine how much time you have on the ground to see the memorials. Others who are having to use commercial flights, they have to stick with a set schedule. So it depends on how much time they have on the ground. But a typical trip, for instance, for me, would be I first go to the World War Dwell, then enter the airport. Hopefully they will be greeted at the airport by their staff. As they are on the aircraft, especially if they're on Southwest Airlines, and I think U.S. Air as well, if the pilots and the flight attendants are aware that they have World War II veterans on there, they often will make an announcement and make it known that there is a World War II veteran, have him ring his call bell, have him raise his hand. So he begins to get some recognition even on the aircraft before he's ever got to Washington. We typically have airport coordinators at all three of the major airports in the D.C. area. And we have a spreadsheet that we distribute to all of our hubs showing who is coming in and what time, what hubs are going to be there. So our airport coordinators and their volunteers will meet the aircraft when it gets in. Whether it's a charter flight or even if it's a commercial flight, they will meet them, make people aware in the boarding area that there are World War II veterans coming in. And generally, when the veterans come through the jetway, they face anywhere from 200 to 300 to 500 people clapping and cheering and welcoming them to Washington or to Baltimore. That's their first idea that it's going to be kind of a special day for them. Most then go to the World War II memorial first. And again, we have volunteers at the memorial. Hundreds of people are generally there waiting for them. Complete strangers are coming up to them, shaking their hands, patting them on the back, giving them a hug, thanking them for their service.
That's just amazing. Another follow-up question.
Okay.
What is the biggest, as far as the women? We're all aware of Rosie the Riveter, et cetera, who kind of, they helped out at home. The veteran World War II women, what type of work did they do during World War II?
Well, a lot were nurses. There were a lot who were working actually secretly in London and areas like that where they were intercepting messages, telecommunications. There was an awful lot of females in the U.S. who were pilots that were shuttling aircraft from coast to coast, either new ones to get them to the coast so they could go into the war zone, or damaged ones that were taken back for repairs. There were hundreds of, in fact, I wish I could remember the number, but there were hundreds of female pilots that flew here in the U.S. And one of the amazing things about it, I've heard even from World War II veterans who were pilots, generally the pilots had expertise in one or two aircraft. The women that were flying them in within the States were flying as many as 8 or 10 different aircraft. So they had to know how to fly all of them, which astounded me.
Yeah, and you also had a lot that were on the staff, you know, as secretaries and gophers. You also had a lot that were drivers, you know,
exactly.
Driving officers or ambulances or whatever. The women filled a myriad number of roles. You know, they weren't just sitting home rolling bandages. You know, they did a lot
That's
of things that never before were being done.
That's correct. And also, I'm not sure if all of you are aware of it, but there is a women's memorial in Washington, D.C., right at Arlington National Cemetery, that is dedicated to all women who have ever served in the military. It's a beautiful facility. I often take my groups there. If I have a female veteran that's in my group, I always stop there for her.
Yeah, a lot of people assume that, you know, because you're a female, you're not going to be involved in the fight, you know, whether it's intellectually or physically, but since our Revolutionary War, women have actually fought on the front line. There are two women that actually received a pension as Army, you know, volunteers from the Revolutionary War. You know, as I said, I dedicate each show to the fallen heroes, whether or not they fell in battle or later on. And I actually dedicated one show to Deborah Sampson, who actually fought, you know, in combat in the Revolutionary War and was wounded and then received a pension. You know,
wow.
Women just don't fit into that typical role that, you know, people have in their head. You know, we're able to do just about everything. Not everything, but just about.
That's right.
We're the strength behind you guys.
Well, as a matter of fact, this past season, flying season, I had a veteran who was a female. We stopped at the World War II Memorial. And, of course, we also went to the Iwo Jima statue, and in her honor, we went to the Women's Memorial. And I discovered that day was also her 93rd birthday. So she got to see all three of those things on her 93rd birthday. She was a Marine.
Bless her heart. Bless her heart.
You know, let's also keep in mind that, I mean, many of the women that we used as spies, I mean, some of them went above and beyond the real call of duty to help their country. Because as we know, for some of the strongest men, their weakest link is women. And that's, you know, I mean, we put them in risk every single time they're doing a mission. Man, I couldn't even imagine what that would be like.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, we got a comment up again in the chat room, and he wrote that the nurses in the MASH units were great. You know, but a lot of the people that were in the MASH units, whether they were orderly or nurses, were actually doing the job of doctors because doctors were such short, you know, supply.
That's great.
So they were a jack of all trades and a master of just one.
There was a funny story where one of the female spies told, I think it was Field Marshal Montgomery's second lieutenant or something, like, wait, don't bomb that place yet. So she comes back an hour later and says, go ahead. And they said, what was the problem? Apparently, her job, obviously, was to buddy up to some people, and she ended up marrying one of the guys. She goes, I had to go withdraw all the money from the bank before you got rid of the city. So, I mean, just, and I got that joke. It was just so funny. I mean, and, you know, it's amazing that just the person who says, if you, for those who forget history are destined to repeat it, it is really amazing how many years later, a lot of people have forgot history, but you haven't. I mean, you're remembering it and remembering these people. There is probably no greater reward than letting these people see that memorial. And I'll tell you, when they mention someone's name on an airplane and they clap, and when they're walking down the runway, that is an amazing feeling, and it's a well-deserved welcome home that so many of these people just never, ever, ever seen. And I mean, it's just amazing what you guys done. I mean, it's just, you know, and it starts out, you said you made a phone call, it was about a commercial flight, and here you got hubs all over. I mean, that is terrific. That is so honorable.
The comment we hear from almost every single veteran at the end of the day is that this is one of the most greatest days of my life. Almost every single veteran makes that same comment. Don't you agree, Jeff?
Yeah, I've had to tell them to be careful about saying that in front of their family. Today it's the greatest day they ever had outside of the family. But, yeah, we know for a fact it's changed lives. I could point out examples of it.
Well, another thing, too, is that you got to – I think a lot of people don't know, and I don't know that we can either. It's kind of like when these people are together. They really can share the things that they've not wanted to talk about or can't, because really there's not, as much as you love your wife or your family, it takes another veteran to really understand the horrors of what these people did, went through, and all the intangibles we just don't know about. And I mean, when they're with their fellow comrades, it's a chance for them to really share some of those things that, you know, probably for many of them haven't talked about in decades.
Yeah, it frees them up. It's Jim mentioned it earlier. They actually come back and start sharing the experiences. Some have even gone so far as to video them or write them down in a journal and present them to their family. I've been privileged to have copies of some of those and be witness to when they gave them to them.
Yeah, well, it's like I said.
Mom, I just said to you, Greg has something planned. Okay, I don't know what Greg has planned, but he's got something going on with his family. Sorry about that.
Okay.
No, I was sorry about that, guys.
Don't worry.
I'm doing the show. My mom kept me, and she says, I told your friend Greg he needs to come here for Christmas. And I'm like, oh God, Mom. Anyway, you know, one of the things I wanted to ask, when you started this, okay, you made the phone call to the airline, and it's just one man. The next thing you know, you got two men. I mean, how many people are on board to this amazing project? I have like eight people in this room right now listening to this when it started out with just me and my brother. I mean, this is how interesting it is. Our neighbors are staying listening to you guys talk.
We don't have a good handle on how many people are involved altogether, but including all 135 hubs, we're talking tens of thousands of volunteers.
Wow.
You know, the hubs are, Chicago Hub, for instance, has something like 1,500 volunteers that work with her.
And when I flew with them a year ago, and when we returned to Midway Airport in Chicago, when the veterans got off the plane, there were over 5,000 people waiting to receive them. It was one of the greatest things I've ever seen. It was amazing. It took 40 minutes to go through the gauntlet of all the well-wishers, and I mean they were cranked up.
Yeah.
That is, oh, my God, that is just so, you're getting a little ovation here in our own living room.
What's so funny, I met they introduced me to this guy. He's just in a green volunteer shirt, Chicago, and I looked at him, and he's just one of the people just there working, helping everybody. He's the guy that owns the Chicago Bears.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, he is the owner of the Chicago Bears. couldn't have been any nicer. I had no idea. I knew I recognized him, and then it hit me. And he's just there in a just a exact same shirt I had on, doing nothing but helping veterans, shaking their hands. No bodyguards, no glitz. He was just there working.
I have a quick question. This lady asked me this. Leona's her name. She's 94. She's next to me. Leona, you want to ask a question yourself? Or she wants to know, what is the oldest veteran you guys have come across since doing this?
107.
107?
We have a veteran in Austin, Texas, who is 107. And recently, in fact, for Veterans Day this year, I received a call from the hub director asking if there was any chance he could get some green passes to take Mr. Overton to D.C. They had received a call from the White House, and the president asked him to come and present the wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier on Veterans Day.
And have dinner with him, I think. It was something even beyond that. It was.
I got a second call from him saying, could we get a couple more tickets? I said, why? I said, well, he wants to take his girlfriend. She's 91.
Damn, dude, get down. He's
That does invoke images in your mind that you really don't want to go there, though.
Hey, these guys, when they're on this trip, they are all 19 and 20 years old again. It's all bets off when they arrive. They have a spring in their step. They hadn't lost an edge at all. It's really funny, and they have a great time, and everybody's a wonderful sport about it and enjoys it.
As it happens, we discovered later that there is a second 170-year-old veteran in Austin, but he's 3 months younger than Mr. Overton, so Mr. Overton is still the oldest one.
The oldest one we ever took was 103, and he was the head of the pigeoneers, the carrier pigeons in Europe, and that was interesting.
Wow.
Holy cow,
those stories are amazing.
Yeah.
Website is honorflight.org. I just want to make sure I get that out there so people know where to go to donate or to see if they can volunteer or whatever. Honorflight.org.
That is the site. Yeah, honorflight.org.
And if they want to know about the movie, it's honorflightthemovie.com. Like I said, I downloaded it and haven't been able to take a look at it yet, but I will be doing that later on tonight. And I really didn't want to do it before the show because I knew as soon as I started talking about this, I would probably start crying.
Get emotional about this, we probably wouldn't like you.
Nothing's wrong with that. I mean, these are people that have paid just such a great sacrifice. I mean, we can't even fathom what these people went through and what they've seen. Like I said, it started out in I'm doing this show in my living room. We have now 10 people just sitting here listening.
I'd like you to look at, go to Honor Air, just HonorAir.com, and go to history and go to the videos and watch the video that Bill Geist, the report he did with CBS Sunday Morning News, or CBS Sunday Morning. It's only about 7.5 minutes, but Bill Geist himself was a combat reporter in Vietnam, and he came down when we did our first flight and participated with us, came in about a week ahead, interviewed four veterans, three of which have since passed away. But that's just a little 7 or 8 minutes to give you a taste of it, but I would like you to do it. Just go to honorair.com, videos and history and videos. And NBC did a great one. Jim Mikleshevsky did an abbreviated version a couple of years later. But it's the only time Bill Geist has ever done a story and then a year later updated it. And we were really privileged, and I give him huge credit for helping us get our part of it going, and then also helping the network as a whole as a great promotional piece, because he did it from the heart, and he did it by doing the story of the veterans primarily.
Right.
Yeah, that film was made in 2006, and then he updated it a year later in 2007. And I urge everyone to, you know, take a few moments. It's only about 7 minutes, and 7 minutes is not a lot of time in your life compared to what these men and women gave during the World War II. You know, it's well worth it.
For people who want to donate, do they go to honorair.com, or is there...
Let's stick with honorflight.org. Honor Air, we're fine on a local level. That's still, we have that just doing things here on a local level. But I want to encourage anyone that wants to give to please go to the national site so we can keep these other hubs going. And, again, that's honorflight.org.
Yeah, and there's a link up in the chat room on there, and I'll add it onto this website, so when people click on the podcast, they'll be able to see the link too. You know, it's a phenomenal thing. You know, I have to say, you know, a lot of these, again, I have to reiterate, a lot of these men and women just never spoke about their service. Matter of fact, this afternoon here in Beaufort, South Carolina, there were 10 veterans that had passed away during the year, and no one came and claimed them because, you know, now the family's scattered, they're gone, may have never had, you know, family once they got back home. But these 10 people, you know, our national cemetery has finally, you know, found a spot for them. You know, they go quietly into the night. And the least we can do is pay honor to them by doing the honor flight.
It's a great way. It's a living memorial is what's so wonderful. It's, you know, they get to have their day with their comrades, and there's no question in their mind when they get home that they're appreciated, that it's been recognized. It's, to me, it's pretty darn flawless, and I'm just thrilled to have been a part of it and to work with Jim and Earl and the board that we have now is a very unselfish group of people. And the hub operators all over the country, it's a passion. It's a gift that we're able to give, but it gives us so much in return.
We recently here reached out to veterans. I was involved in a political race, and we were certainly the underdog going against the person with the bundles and bundles of money, but we reached out to the veterans, and it was amazing on the last Saturday before the campaign how many came out to support her. Many of them obviously limping, many of them still wounded, wheelchair. I mean, they just came out, and it was like an army. And I'll tell you something. Some of these veterans still at their age, man, they got some balls on them. One of them confronted our opponent, and I didn't catch the whole story of it, but I remember he looked at it and says, "You want to try me, boy?" And I'm like, "Oh, come on, guys, let's not get." But, I mean, this guy's got to be 80. I'm like, man, go get him. But, I mean, it was just how, right there, how committed they were to somebody who helped them. And they're such good people, I mean, of giving back. Needless to say, we pulled off the upset, and, boy, they certainly still can drink, that's for sure. They cost us 3 kegs election night.
Well, we don't go there. We try to keep the alcohol away from them on our group. The Louisiana group was notorious for trying to get back to the airport early so they could go to the bar. And they said, well, we're from Louisiana. We don't have good water, so we drink beer. But one thing that Honor Flight does is, for sure, we stay out of politics and we stay out of the bars. We just want to get them home and have them nice and healthy.
Well,
they're a big
do each of you guys have, I know there's obviously great stories. Do one of you have a favorite story that just sticks out in your mind as I don't know, maybe your favorite or the most emotional story or just one for each of you?
Go ahead, Jim, and I know what mine is. Go ahead if you're ready.
Well, I've got a real quick one. We stay, when I take my groups, we stay overnight, and we stay at a Hilton Hotel. The hotel staff have just been fantastic with the veterans. And several years ago, I had a World War II veteran who was a Marine. He was a big, tall man. He was from way back in the Ozarks. Saturday morning, I came downstairs for breakfast. He had just finished his breakfast and was coming out of the dining room. He stopped me. He says, "Jim, you ain't going to believe what just happened to me." I said, "What's that?" He said, "I was sitting in there eating my breakfast, you know. Sure, the chef come out to the kitchen, that big old fancy hat, you know, like they wear? And I said, yes, sir. He said, he wanted to shake my hand. And this man was so thrilled that that chef came out and wanted to shake his hand. I said, well, mister, you got a lot more of that in store for you today.
That is a neat story. The chef comes out.
there's a lot of people come out. Mine's a little bit deeper that because it crossed a couple of different eras. This gentleman from in my area wanted to go. He was even before we had a TLC, their Last Chance program. He had been diagnosed the way he was deteriorating that he probably had 6 months to a year to live. But he really wanted to go. And the kicker to it, he was a World War II veteran. The kicker to it was his son had enlisted in the military when he was of age, gone to Vietnam, was killed, and they'd never recovered his body. So he really wanted, after the World War II memorial, he wanted to go to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. And we knew this was going to be something totally different for us. We assigned him a friend of his, he didn't even really know it, happened to be a Vietnam veteran, heavy combat. So he was his guardian for the day. His name was, the veteran's name was Curtis, and the guardian was Bruce. And so we toured the World War II Memorial. He was in a wheelchair. He never got out of the wheelchair. We went straight over to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, and I'd called ahead. We've got wonderful connections in D.C. now, and I want to add the Park Service. Everybody saw the horrible side of things with the shutdown, but the actual people on the ground there and Bob Vogel and the folks there were in charge of the memorial, they weren't into this, and they were wonderful. That's another whole story. But we had called ahead, and we had Vietnam veterans waiting for this gentleman. And they, along with the Park Service Rangers, escorted him in the wheelchair down to where his son's name was on the wall. And fate would have it to where he could touch it from his wheelchair. And I just stayed back. And they escorted him down, and these Vietnam veterans built a bubble really around him. As Curtis had time to not have closure, but to have time with his son, because he had never been there. And he called me in, and he asked me to come over, and he said, I want to thank you for this opportunity. I really feel like it'll help. Like I said, he wasn't supposed to be here much longer. Well, I kept checking on him, and he kept improving. And 2 years later, this state magazine, our state, wanted to do a story on some of the veterans that had gone. And on a whim, I called Curtis, and he said he would love to be there and do an interview and do the stories. And I asked him if he'd like me to send somebody, and he said no. It's 2 years later now. I'm waiting on him in front of the old historic courthouse in Hendersonville, and that guy pulls up in a brand-new car, driving it himself, gets out. He's in a suit. He's got this big, white, wide-brim hat on and a cane. And that man came out of there. He looked like $1 million, and he stayed there for 2 hours for photoshoot and the stories. And
wow.
He told me that the entire thing had changed his life. Talked to him the other day, and he's still doing well. He was not supposed to be here.
Well, that is amazing. I got a final question before, as we kind of wind down, for all three of you. Jim, Jeff, and Annie, I got to get you involved in politics here this weekend. Army or Navy? I go Army.
I'm not touching it.
I'm not either.
Oh, come on, you big twit. Oh, come on.
Big no. Now, I'll tell you what, Jim. You pick Army, I'll pick Navy, and we cover everything.
There you go. That'll work.
On my end, it has to be Navy because I'm in the heart of the Tri-Command. I've got the Marine Corps Air Station Buford here. I've got the Paris Island Recruit Depot for the Marine Corps here, and I've got the Navy Hospital. If I don't go Navy, I'm going to have a lot of angry neighbors.
Well, my dad was in the Navy, so I'll go that side. Jim's got Army. So, you know, like I said, we're a big tent group, man.
You know what's really amazing? It's got to be when those men get off the plane, men and women, but they've just got to be new people. You know, in many, many ways, as we, I mean, it just, I can't even fathom this. I've got to get on a flight. I mean, I've got to do it. I've got to experience this.
Do you have just a second? I'll tell you one real quick one if you do.
Yeah,
at Arlington. Okay. That was one of the coolest things. The Arlington guards were coming back away from the changing, and, you know, everybody has to stand aside and let them go through. One of our veterans, a lot of time they wear their medals. One veteran had his medals on, and one of them had a torn ribbon and was hanging there. The Tomb of the Unknown soldier was going by him and stopped right in front of him. And I thought, oh, man, did he say something? And he turned around and looked at this veteran. He came out of his character, unpinned the veteran's torn ribbon medal, put it in his hand, took the one off of his uniform that was just like it but newer, obviously, pinned it on the gentleman, saluted him, went back into character, and walked off. And this little man looked like he was about to wet his pants. He didn't know what had just happened, but that guy had seen that torn ribbon, come back to him and pinned his on it, and walked off.
That is amazing. That is
way cool.
That is amazing.
That's the type of people that are the tomb guards too.
Oh yeah.
I don't know how long we've been doing this show, Annie, or how long been with you, but this is the greatest show we've ever done. This is amazing.
Well, as I always say, we can never say thank you enough. Well, Jim and Jeff, this has been a great pleasure, and I'm urging everyone to go to honorflight.org and either donate or volunteer their time for these veterans. If they know of a veteran that can benefit from your organization, I urge them to help, get them to help that veteran to do it. My father passed just this past October, and I wish that I was able to have him go, but he just simply didn't want to leave home. He just... I'm happy here, you know, give someone else the seat. But I can't say enough for you guys. You know, God bless you all for what you're doing.
Thank you for helping put our story out there. There's hubs everywhere needing assistance, and you guys have a loud voice, and we appreciate it.
Yes, thank you very much for the opportunity.
Oh, that's great. Hey, you guys tune in anytime. This was a Meek show. But great.
Never want
thank
us back,
so
Michelle. If, you know, if you get desperate and need another one, you know, here we are.
Well, we had 15 candidates on all at once. But gentlemen, God bless you for what you do and your continued support. And you know, thank you so much.
You're certainly welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, it's honorflight.org. I urge everyone to go there, and you know, either even if it's a buck, you donate. Just donate something or volunteer your time. As I said, I downloaded the movie last night, which I'll be watching later on tonight. I just didn't have time to watch it last night. But I can't say enough of these two angels. No other way to describe them. They're angels. Well, Mike, we're down to our final 2 minutes, and we've had a blast. We'll be back on Tuesday. Tuesday, we're going to have Reverend Leon Wynn on. He is running against Representative James Clyburn for his U.S. Congress seat. So it's going to be very interesting. I understand he's quite a character, and I'll be talking to him a little bit later on to schedule everything. But he'll be on with us on Tuesday. So everyone have a great weekend, and come back to us on Tuesday. Same bat time, same bat station. Until then, be safe, and God bless you all.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble.
You've been listening to Southern Sense Blog Talk Radio. Producer and your hostess extraordinaire is Ann Ubelis. The theme music, American Stand Up, is written and performed by Don Fortney. For more from Don, check out his webpage, teapartymusic.web.com. Southern Sense is a proud member of Ghost Fighter Radio and Freedom Media Network. Southern Sense is common sense. Take it out, Don.
Americans.